The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
The inimitable Stevie Wonder there. It's always good to hear from him, but what, you might wonder, does he have to do with 2012? The answer involves this man.
I know you've been hurt by someone else. I can tell by the way you carry yourself. But if you let me, here's what I'll do. I'll take care of you.
Yes, that was the equally great Gil Scott-Heron, one of the people who died in 2011, but whose memory will live on not least with the release of The Last Holiday, one of the first footers in the new publishing year, which comes with this clever little teaser.
Dr. Martin Luther King had a dream, and Stevie Wonder had a dream. This is a book about dreams.
It's being published by Canongate on January the 16th, which in a neat bit of publishing sleight of hand is a public holiday in the US marking the birthday of Martin Luther King. With me here in the studio to unravel this and other mysteries of the new publishing year are Benedicta Page of The Bookseller and Sarah Crown, editor of The Guardian's books website. Welcome to both of you. Hello. Sarah, can you just explain what on earth I've been on about.
In the autumn of 1980, Stevie Wonder invited Gil Scott-Heron to join him on a 41-city tour across America, which ended in Washington in January in 1981. And the idea was to gather popular support for the creation of a holiday in honour of Martin Luther King, great civil rights leader. Gil Scott-Heron uses this history-making tour as the backbone of his memoir. And Ronald Reagan signed the holiday into law in 1983, and it was first observed on January the 20th, 1986, and it's now observed across all 50 of the states in America.
Yes, that's typically Canongate, isn't it, to do something like that and connect with a public event like that.
Yeah, it's very, as you say, it's a very neat piece of publishing.
It's not the only anniversary that's going to feature next year, is it, Sarah, at all? I mean, we're into the first anniversary of the Arab Spring. Well, we're into it in January. Why is that?
It's funny this, isn't it, how suddenly anniversaries in publishing come around so quickly, and the Arab Spring is really still going on, but we're now already commemorating it, which feels to me a little bit previous, but there you go. Bloomsbury are publishing two books about the Arab Spring in January. One is called Arab Women in the News, Old Stereotypes and New Media, and another one by Adaf Sweff is called Cairo, My City, My Revolution. And she, of course, was around a lot when Egypt was going through the Arab Spring, which was sort of last January. She's a very prominent Egyptian writer and she was commentating a lot, so I'm sure that a book by her on it will be very interesting, give a good overview.
We're going to get a lot more of those as the year goes on, I suspect. So another big anniversary is the 30th of the Falklands War. Sarah, you were undoubtedly too young to remember it, but
yes,
I do.
I was only four, I think, at the time. But it's one of those things that you, even though I don't actually remember it being on the news, I feel like I do. It was so dominant during the 1980s, the imagery of it, and obviously all the fallout that came afterwards, and the fact that, among other things, it meant that we had a Thatcher government for quite some time afterwards. So repercussions were felt.
There are a couple of memoirs coming out. One is by Chris Parry, who was a helicopter officer, but he rose to become Rear Admiral, and he's now all over the BBC in broadcasting. He's one of the top strategic thinkers, and it's called Down South, the Falklands War Diary. And there's another from Tony Banks called Storming the Falklands, and it's a veteran's memoir. And I'm sure we'll have lots more of those. Intriguingly, one of the publisher, little startup publisher, which scored a bit of a success in the Guardian First Book Award this year and other stories, has got in on this one with another South American novel. They published Down the Rabbit Hole, which was our readers' nomination for the first book prize. Tell us a little bit about The Islands. Sarah?
Yes, this time the book is set in Argentina, and it's by an author called Carlos Gamero. And by all accounts, it's absolutely brilliant. The background is the Falklands again, and it's sort of remembering how awful it was, you know, for the people who lived there. And it also goes some way towards satirising the myths and conspiracies that have grown up around the Falklands War in Argentina.
Clever of them to have gone for that side as well, isn't it? Because we'll have presumably quite a lot of gung-ho stuff from looking at it from our side.
Yeah, looking at it from the perspective of people in the UK, whereas in fact, you know, as at the time, we rather are in danger of overlooking the people who actually live there.
OK, so much for political history. What about now? We have drafted into the studio our very own Nick Cohen, who we put under orders to give us a whistle-stop tour of his book, which is one of the earliest books of the year, which is going to get everything off to a fighting start. And it's rather intriguingly called You Can't Read This Book, Nick. You're under starter's orders.
I feel like I'm on a speed date. I've got 30 seconds to impress you before you move on to the next cap. It's a book about censorship. That's why it's called You Can't Read This Book, about modern censorship and how it works and how to oppose it. It is based on the argument behind it is fighting the rather glib techno-utopianism that is very commonplace, very easy to succumb to. I've succumbed to it myself, of, well, the web, it just answers all the old problems about censorship and freedom of speech, and look, and Google can set you free and microchips can set you free. And it's divided into three parts. It looks at the power of religion to censor, which is essentially from Salman Rushdie onwards. It looks at the power of money to censor, which inevitably looks at the libel law in Britain, which has become a sort of global menace. Plutocrats from all over the world can come here to punish their critics. But also at a censorship I suspect we all follow and just take for granted, that you can denounce politicians, you know, programmes like this in the strongest possible terms, maddest possible terms, but if you go public and criticise your employers, you will be fired. And you'll probably not get another job in your area of work again, because no other manager wants you on their team, as they put it. And in the banking crisis, one of the most extraordinary things about the world we're in is we had no forewarning of what was about to hit us in 2008. Still is hitting us, pummeling us, really, because people in banks who knew things were going wrong wouldn't speak out. And that was just taken for granted. And then the last part looks at the power of states to censor, and really becomes an argument about the net, which I don't dismiss. You know, there's a very brilliant Belarusian writer called Evgeny Morozov, who essentially just says the net is no good. It's no good for helping freedom. I don't quite say that, but it does allow an illusion. Our notion of tyranny comes from Hitler, from Stalin, from Orwell. We don't understand that most dictatorships don't have total control, totalitarian control. They have effective control. It doesn't actually matter that much if a dissident can have a little corner on the net. What matters is political action, is can you take that information and fight for change? Mm-hmm. And as soon as you try to do that, you're up against all the old problems of politics.
Now, have you been having a nice time with the lawyers, the Fourth Estate lawyers?
Well, no. Lawyers have now become... I know lawyers better than my wife now. I mean, it's sort of...
This book came in very late, didn't it? Because you were having arguments with the lawyers.
Yeah, to an extent, because I don't think, in all honesty, you can write a book about censorship without pushing it as hard as you can. In the 1930s, every British newspaper, including The Guardian, The Observer, even The Daily Worker, the Communist Party newspaper, just automatically didn't discuss Edward VIII's affair with Mrs. Simpson. They censored themselves completely. Now, that such things are unthinkable, but you look at the Danish cartoons, no British newspaper carried them. You look at proper investigations into what's going on in the banks, law of libel, fear, also the absence of sources, meant the banking crisis comes out. So you've got to push it as hard as you can, and the lawyers have quite rightly, you know, been a bit worried. But essentially, in the end, all they ask is you make sure your facts are absolutely right. So that's not a bad thing. But
I'm going to stop you there, partly because I want to keep you here to just talk about a couple of the other books that are coming up about the now. There are obviously going to be a lot of money books around, because we're in a money is
rightly
a big feature.
Yes.
So tell us about some of the other books that have caught your attention. I know you're very keen on Thomas Frank's Pity the Billionaire.
Yeah, I've seen him in print, and I would just urge listeners to read Tom Frank. I mean, he's a magnificent satirist. And this book is about how strange it is that after the worst crash in Wall Street since 1929, after Americans lose trillions of dollars of wealth, and sensible commentators all say, well, surely the Republican right is over, how the Tea Party bounces back again and wins massively in the 2010 congressional elections, And Tom, if you've never read him, it's an absolute pleasure because he writes beautifully. And he's not remotely like Michael Moore or people I've got very little time for. He's an old-fashioned American populist leftist from the Midwest. He's from Kansas. And he's just got this belief entirely vindicated by history, I should say. He's always had this about how Wall Street just robs ordinary Americans. Mm-hmm. And he's very good at showing how right-wing ideas are now successfully dressed up in the language of rebellion, the language of populism, and how ludicrous it all is.
There's a really strong moral element in these titles. There's How Much is Enough? That's Robert and Edward Skidelsky. Skidelsky, of course, is Keynes's biographer. And What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of Markets, which is Michael Sandel. Are you familiar with these?
Well, Michael Sandel is a professor at Harvard who is read all over the world. Funnily enough, he's one of the few people that the communists allow Chinese students to listen to in China, because he does raise these questions in a society where inquisitiveness is running out of control. Skidelsky, I think, is always worth reading as well.
Ben, is this going to be the year of the e-book? That's what everybody's been saying.
It really is. Claire, we've been talking about this for a couple of years now.
But you always say it. And last year you said it. And
you don't believe it. It has grown massively in the industry this year. And it's only going to grow even more massively next year. I think this time last year, e-books were in the very low percent, maybe 1%, maybe 2%, maybe 3% of total book sales of publishers. Now they're up at 10% and beyond, and you know, the sky's the limit. Publishers are, you know, openly discussing when the tipping point is likely to come, the point where their business is half digital and half physical books. And you know, we did a survey quite recently that said it was 2020, the majority of global publishers thought it would be 2020. But you know, talking to publishers around me in the last couple of weeks, it's, you know, they're talking about 2015. So you know, another couple of months, who knows where it'll be. It is upon us, fast and furious, very much so. Obviously, there are going to be new devices coming to the UK next year. Amazon Fire, we're expecting, which is the tablet device, the Kindle Fire. And that means that you can look at illustrated books on it. So that's going to give a whole new fillip to the market. Lots of rumours that Barnes & Noble's Nook is going to come here in some guise. You know, Waterstones are keen to develop an e-reader. So it's going to be everywhere. Yeah, absolutely. And also internationally, it's worth bearing that in mind. You know, it's been obviously massive in the States. It has essentially been an English language phenomenon up to now, dominated phenomenon. You know, there's a huge amount of introspection and forward-looking and debate going on in the industry at the moment. And we definitely shouldn't just be thinking about e-books. We should be thinking about the whole concept of digital publishing. That's certainly where publishers are. They're very much thinking of their role in new terms, really. They want us to think of, if you're talking about a novel, for example, to think of the story and its readers rather than the individual platform. So rather than a physical platform or a digital platform, or even, you know, if you're doing something for young adults, a virtual reality game. Do you know what I mean? They want to think of it in a much, much broader way. They're really rethinking their whole role.
Will they be paying authors more for this?
Well, that's, of course, the great...
There speaks an author.
just wondering.
Well, that is, of course, the great issue. I mean, what's interesting is that, in a way, it's offering some publishers and some authors who choose to self-publish amazing new opportunities. I was talking to one tiny publisher this week, which was saying that it had sold 75,000 copies of one of its ebooks over 2 months this year. You know, a phenomenal number for a tiny publisher. And obviously without the same risks that you have when you invest in the physical product. But did they sell them at a price that they could make much profit from? Not really. So there's a whole other issue about how the divvying up of the rewards for writing and publishing and retailing happens in this new environment. And that's yet to be decided or settled down. And, you know, many people, including many authors, have, you know, worries and concerns about how their living is going to be shaped in this new world.
Can I just ask around this table, who among us read on tablets, read e-books?
Not me.
No?
I have an e-reader, yeah, I do.
Which e-reader do you have?
I have a Kindle.
And do you read on it?
I'm trying to learn to. I'm terribly old school, and I'm, but I am very much behind the times on this. I really am. So many people are saying, "Well, I've tried it, and I'm absolutely loving it, and it's transforming my reading practice." So I feel like a very, very late adopter.
How about you, Nick?
Our employers here, Claire, absolutely. Famous generosity allowed us to get iPads at half price last week, and I've got my first Kindle books on there. They're very useful for it's very useful for research.
It's quite useful for research, but it's also quite good for those of us with adult eyesight, shall we say?
Yes.
I find I quite like being able to make the print bigger, particularly if I'm reading on public transport where the light's not very good.
So are you taking to it, Claire?
Yeah. Well, yes. I have a Sony Reader, which. Of course, Harry Potter is going. Pottermore has partnered up with. So I'm hanging on to that. Though I thought it had disappeared into one of those historical sidings, and a Kobe, which I've just been given, which has the penguin shorts on it, and I am just getting to grips with my Christmas Kindle.
Is Amazon developing a sort of monopoly of e-books? I'm very wary about that. There's EU investigations into publishers setting prices for e-books. And that just strikes me as the wrong way around. What a good antitrust law ought to be looking at, I know, the power of Amazon with e-books and the power of Tesco with dead tree books. Instead of looking at the suppliers, they should be looking at the middlemen who seem to be utterly in control.
Well, you know, there's certainly no two ways about it. Amazon is in a very strong position in the market, particularly if you put together its retailing of print books and its retailing of e-books. When the market was really in print, it was strong. But when the market's in print and in e, that puts it in an extremely strong position at the moment. So certainly, you know, there are worries about keeping the market diverse.
OK, now we're going to let Nick go and carry on dancing with his lawyers. Sarah, hand in hand with this idea of this new moralism about money, which was so unfashionable in the Labour years, oddly, there's all this talk about big society. Are we seeing that reflected in publishing?
Yes, to an extent, I think we are. I mean, I think big society as an idea is so much more nebulous and has caught the public imagination so much less successfully than the, oh my God, we've got no money problem that we're dealing with now. But it is coming through in publishing. We have a book by Richard Sennett, which is coming out from Allen Lane in February, called Together, The Rituals, Pleasures and Politics of Cooperation. So that suddenly kind of keys into the
he's
idea.
He's very clever, Richard Sennett, isn't he? He did a book about craftsmanship. And I just thought he's very good at sort of finding the moment to bring out something which somehow catches a sociological movement.
Yeah, and there's also, I mean, it also kind of hooks into the idea of, you know, to the financial question as well, because I think there is a sort of cultural sense that we're, you know, bit blitz spirit, we're all going to have to sort of go back to the land pit and try and work things out. And so the idea of cooperation, and also, of course, cooperation is a really good, strong left-wing thing to do as well. So, yeah, and good for him, I say.
It's just as well we got rid of Nick, because I wonder what he would have made of Roger Scruton. That would have kept him going for a while, wouldn't it? So yes. Roger Scruton arguing in Green Philosophy that conservatism is the greenest political movement. Yeah, I think we'll pass over
questionable,
that one. Which brings us to all the various nature books that are coming up.
Yeah, and again, nature has been a really strong theme in publishing for a couple of years now, and it continues this year, or so it would seem. The one that I'm probably most excited about is actually coming out in June. It's called The Old Ways by Robert McFarlane, who wrote Mountains of the Mind, which I absolutely loved. And this is about walking ancient paths in the UK, which I think could be so interesting. So I'm really excited about that.
I like the idea of bird sense, what it's like to be a bird. by Tim Burkhead, which I really like the idea of being a bird. Moving on to a slightly more literary tangent, Ben, and also moving back to anniversaries, it's 20 years since Angela Carter died. Can it really be?
I know, it seems incredible, doesn't it? I remember the event so well. She was an incredibly formative writer for me growing up, and it was a great shock when she died really very early, very tragically, from lung cancer. And amazingly, this is the first biography of her. It's not a sort of formal biography, but it's the first sort of biographical study of her, I suppose, is how you would describe it. It's called A Card from Angela Carter, and it's been written by Susanna Clapp, who was a friend of hers for many years. I think Angela wrote for Susanna at the London Review of Books. And it is rather beautifully structured around a number of postcards that Angela sent sort of sporadically to Susanna on various occasions and from various parts of the world.
Sarah, it's also, and I don't know whether you know this, this is a little bit of hot information. It's the year that Virginia Woolf and James Joyce come out of copyright. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
It's very exciting.
And well, so, yeah, I'd be very excited if I were a
And guess who are onto it immediately? It's Canongate. And they're doing an edition of Orlando introduced by Tilda Swinton, which is that's going to be quite fun, I should think. So that just moves us on to fiction. So let's go through the fiction year. And Sarah, will you start with January?
Sure. Well, it's a fairly slow start to the year for fiction. Probably the most interesting book in January is Amanda Hocking's new novel, Switched. She was a big self-publishing phenomenon. She did incredibly well by self-publishing, and now she's moved over to Pan Macmillan, and this is her first book with them. So that's it'll be interesting to see what that does as well.
Fairly schlocky vampire stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, but that sells, I think.
Nothing wrong with vampires.
No.
Or zombies, for that matter. February begins to get a bit more going in February, doesn't it?
Yes. February is marked by short stories. In fact, I thought, looking through the list, that there were a lot of short stories this year, which is, I think, is fairly encouraging, probably. The first collection on the 2nd of February coming out, I think, is by Alexander McLeod, and that's called Light Lifting, published by Jonathan Cape. And then, great title, this one, What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank by Nathan England.
Oh, talk about pressing all the buttons.
Yeah. Yeah, you've got two demographics right there, haven't you? And that's out in February as well.
And Ben, there's one that you're particularly interested in, which is the Helen Dunmore Greatcoat.
The Greatcoat, yes, I absolutely love this book. It's a ghost story, essentially, by Helen Dunmore. And rather wonderfully, she was commissioned to do this by a new imprint of Random House called Hammer. It's a sort of joint venture with the people who produced the Hammer House of Horror, no less. And they are publishing various sort of scary and thrilling titles, but they've also commissioned a number of literary authors to write pieces for them, including Helen. And The Greatcoat, it's wonderful. It is a sort of story of ghostly possession, and it's set in the 1950s, and it looks back to wartime, and it's
don't just give
wonderful.
Too much away, because we're all going to have to go away and read it. Sarah, March.
Yes, in March, things start to really speed up a bit in March. We've got a new novel by William Boyd set in Vienna in 1913. That's called Waiting for Sunrise. And then we have a novel by John Lanchester called Capital. Now, this is drawing on, many people this year might have read his book on the financial markets, Oops. And this is kind of the novelised version of that. So I'm really looking forward to that, and I think he's a brilliant writer. And he's been so sort of focused on non-fiction for a while that it'll be really nice to see him going back to fiction, I think.
Mm-hmm. OK, so April.
This month we have a book by Ian Banks, who has dropped the M this time. He's been Ian M. Banks for quite a few years now, and he's gone back to some straight fiction, which I think a lot of people will be really pleased by, because in many ways his literary fiction is more widely respected, I suppose, than his science fiction. This book is called Stonemouth, and it sounds like a sort of typically gritty, grimy, depressing outing by Ian Banks. So, you know, I'm sure there'll be lots of people excited about that.
Anne Tyler's back again, The Beginner's Goodbye.
This one is apparently about a wife who comes back from the dead, which sounds wife, very Anne Tyler, back from the dead, not so Anne Tyler, so I'm not quite sure where that's going to go.
In fact, Back from the Dead sounds more Stephen King.
Yes.
And Stephen King also has.
Also out in April. It's another Dark Tower novel, this one. It's called The Wind Through the Keyhole. And the reaction to his most recent one, which is about the assassination of JFK, was quite mixed, so hopefully this one will hit the notes a bit more.
So this brings us to the climax of the spring publishing season, which is Hilary Mantel's Bring Up the Bodies. Well, we're excited about it anyway, aren't we, Sarah?
Yes, I can't be the only one who's most excited by this of all the books in 2012 that I've seen so far. It's, as you said, it's no longer a sequel. It's the second book in the trilogy. It deals with all the events from the end of Wolf Hall up to the execution of Anne Boleyn. As with everything that Hilary Mantel writes, I'm quite convinced it will be absolutely brilliant. I just can't wait for it. I love Wolf Hall so much. Also in May, we have another book by, a novel this time by Paul Theroux, called The Lower River, about a man who returns to an African village. And a book from Alain Mabonku about Paris and the Congo. Apparently that's Black Bazaar.
And Richard is very keen on that.
Yes.
And we've featured him on this podcast, which is why we particularly wanted to mention that. But the other one is Simon Moore's The Girl Who Fell from the Sky. Now, I absolutely love The Glass Room. Were you a fan of The Glass Room?
A huge fan. And again, actually, it came at he's exactly in sync with Hilary Mantel again, because he was really the only contender in with any sort of a shot against her in the Booker, where she won with Wolf Hall. So hope he doesn't find himself in the same position again this year, because it was an absolutely brilliant book, The Glass Room, and it's covering similar sort of territory. It's Europe and the Second World War, so... You know, I'm looking forward to that one a lot as well.
And we've got, but looking a little bit further ahead, we've got Michael Frayn doing a mislaid identity farce, which is called Skios, which is coming from Faber in June. We've got Martin Amis doing a book called Lionel Asbo. Oh, I can see the grimaces around the other side of the table as we speak. And it's a State of the Nation novel, and that's out in July. There's a novel by Michael Palin, which I'm quite interested in, to hear about. And then in the autumn we have Pat Barker and Zadie Smith. Very lastly, Sarah, you're a great poetry fan. Give us just a couple of the high notes in poetry next year.
Okay, it looks like there are going to be quite a few high notes, actually. Probably the collection that's coming out, which will have the widest reach, is a collection edited by Caroline Duffy for the Queen's Jubilee. It's called Jubilee Lines, quite neatly. And it has 60 poets, all of the, you know, the great poets writing in the UK today. So 60 years all the way through to 2011, 2012, presumably. And they... you know, pick an event from that year or write about their sense of that year. I interviewed Simon Armitage the other week and he was saying that he has 1982, which of course is the Falklands, which we were talking about earlier, and he's taken a bit from his new book, The Death of King Arthur.
So that neatly brings us back to our theme of anniversaries. Thank you very much for coming in, Ben and Sarah, and a very happy new year to both of you, and also to our producer, Tim Mabey. I'm Claire Armistead. Goodbye.
I'll take care of you. I'll take care of you. I'll take care of you.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1 month, no commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.